Hello, this is Jean Binswanger of TOF Publications. The interview you are about to hear is a preview for Harry Binswanger's upcoming teleclass on How We Know. This is based on his book of the same name, and enrollees in the class will be receiving a draft copy by email, an electronic version, of the manuscript of the book. The class is going to be held eight Wednesdays starting March 10th from 8 p.m. Eastern to 9:40 Eastern. Everything you want to know about the course and registering for the course you can find at hblist.com/lecs. That's hblist.com/lecs. Recently, Srikant Rangnekar interviewed Dr. Binswanger about the book and the class and what's new. Let's turn to that now.
This is Srikant Rangnekar, and I'm interviewing Harry Binswanger about his book and about his course. So, Harry, I'm delighted that the book is almost over. It's almost ready. And I'm very excited about the course. So let's start by talking about the book. How did you come to want to write this book?
That's an interesting story. In the late 90s, I joined a discussion online with people who were not objectivists, but who were interested in consciousness. As you know, consciousness had been banned from both psychology and to some extent from philosophy during most of the 20th century, and then with the decline of behaviorism, it became respectable to discuss consciousness, to use the term. There was an internet discussion group I joined where I thought that perhaps I could make some progress in presenting rational ideas on consciousness. And after going around a few times, I found that there were certain fundamentals that were not agreed to by the participants. So I made a list of, I believe, six things that I thought were required to discuss the nature of consciousness, such things as the primacy of existence and that consciousness is real and has causal efficacy. And it occurred to me I ought to write this out and make an article about it. And at the same time, I was coming to a period where I had been teaching for many years in the Objectivist Graduate Center, Objectivist Academic Center, and I was learning an awful lot while I was teaching. And I wanted to put down the new ideas and new perspectives that I gained from teaching. So these coalesced in my mind with the need to write a book centered on consciousness. So that's the long story.
Wonderful. Let's go into the details of the book. What does the book cover?
The book covers everything from the beginning of metaphysics up through the end of epistemology. And it is capped off with a chapter on free will. Now, hierarchically, I think free will precedes much of the material on epistemology, all of it in normative epistemology proper, because the reason why you need such a science as epistemology is to guide your choices. But I was not sure that I wanted to discuss free will that early, because in my discussion I go into a whole lot of details about what is focus, how does focus differ from concentration, what is evasion, what is the relation of the choice to think to sub-choices, a lot of rich detail. And it seemed inappropriate before I had discussed what are concepts, what is logic. And I noticed that Ayn Rand, in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, does not cover volition extensively. There's, you know, there's a mention of it, reference to the choice that one has on a conceptual level, that she didn't cover it at the beginning. And I realized that for my purposes as, of this book, I didn't need to cover it until the end. So even though in a book like OPAR, where it's presenting everything in hierarchical epistemological order, it does need to be covered early. In my book, which is concerned more with what is consciousness and what are its various cognitive activities, it could be postponed into the end. Of course, like Ayn Rand and ITOE, I do make reference to the fact that man has choice. I just don't go into a long discussion of that topic until the end.
What would you say is the theme of the book?
This was the hardest part for me, to identify a theme. I spent years trying to find a theme that would summarize everything I wanted to say. And I was encouraged by colleagues to write the book that maybe it would have several themes. Just get it out and maybe the theme would emerge. And in fact, a cluster of themes has emerged. I would say essentially it really is consciousness as identification. Since I already used that for a lecture title, it's not appropriate for the book. Also, it's Ayn Rand's phrase. And it's a little wider and yet a little narrower than that. But it's the idea, the theme of the book is the idea that the cognitive processes that one goes through are active cognitive processes that are based upon reality but guided by volition according to standards. So just very recently I changed the title. It was going to be consciousness. First it was going to be consciousness, a causal approach, but then it was going to be just consciousness. And it just came to me that really, essentially, this is a book on epistemology. So I changed the title to How We Know, which I like because it's real short, simple. And once you've heard it, you think you've heard it before. Oh, yes, isn't that a famous classic book, How We Know? So that's the theme. And the sub-themes or the corollary themes are Plato was wrong, Aristotle was right. That summarizes so much that I was realizing about what I was writing in epistemology, that Plato's influence is much stronger than appears at first sight. This is a book that stresses the inductive nature of knowledge and constantly criticizes the top-down approach, as I sometimes call it, which stems from Plato.
Who is this book addressed to? What knowledge does it assume?
In essence, it assumes no knowledge. It is not written to objectivists. It is not presented as the objectivist theory. It's presented as, and is in fact, based on my understanding of objectivism, but it goes a little bit beyond what's already presented by Ayn Rand, and in part represents my own ideas, and I didn't want to have to draw the line exactly where Ayn Rand's input ended and my contribution ended, began. But it doesn't presuppose any knowledge of either previous history of philosophy or objectivism.
Is it addressed to academics?
Not really. I make some attempt through footnotes to smooth the way for people interested in and familiar with the history of philosophy, such as an academic would be, to understand the context of the book. But no, it is not essentially written for academics.
What are the chapters in this book?
Well, the chapters are pretty much hierarchical. The first chapter is definitely hierarchical. It's the metaphysical foundations of cognition. And that will be the most familiar material for objectivists because I had to represent that material to those who don't know objectivism. The second chapter is perception, which is a much more extensive discussion of perception than is in the objectivist literature. And attempts to integrate some of the findings of James J. Gibson, the psychologist on perception, into a proper theory of perception. Chapter 3 is concept formation, and that's the one that was based on my consciousness as identification most closely, but contrary to what I originally thought, no chapter in this book is a representation or even closely following of any of my audio lectures. So those of you who've heard consciousness as identification or my lectures on free will, the material covered, of course, will be very similar, although expanded here. But I don't think you'll find hardly any sentences the same. The organization is not the same. So don't think that if you've bought the lectures, you can avoid buying this course. This course is completely, the book, obviously, is completely written afresh. The only exception is that first chapter in Metaphysical Foundations, which after it was written for the book, I gave as a lecture at a conference about 4 years ago. So that was the first three chapters, Metaphysical Foundations, the Axioms, Perception, and Concept Formation. Then the next chapter is Abstraction from Abstractions. Then the next chapter, 5, is Norms for Cognition. And by norms for cognition, I mean logic. I mean standards of objectivity. What is objectivity? What are the standards for judging mental processes? Chapter 6 is conceptual knowledge, which is how are concepts actually used in making propositional knowledge. There's a considerable new material in that. Chapter 7, which I am now completing, is fundamentality. Fundamentality is the thing that's most conspicuously ignored or not even thought of in the contemporary world. And I had some things to say about that, culminating in a discussion of principles and the role of principles and why principles are contextual absolutes. Then the final chapter is the free will chapter. That's chapter 8.
How would you compare the material of this book with Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology?
Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology covers what I cover in what I may presumptuously call an expanded form. In chapter 3 and 4 and a little bit in 5, that is, concept formation, of course, is the heart of it. Abstraction from abstractions is a chapter in ITOE. Norms for cognition, there's a little bit of that in the cognitive role of concepts. The other topics are not treated in ITOE, so it's a little broader in scope, I would say considerably broader in scope. And, of course, a lot longer. ITOE is about 70 book pages in its early format. And my book is about 300 pages.
Could you give us some highlights from the book, especially new ideas?
Well, I don't want to give away a lot of things, but there's new material on perception. And particularly from the Gibsonian perspective, I criticize, for instance, the idea of sensations as a stage in the development of man. This is a scientific issue, not a philosophical one, but it ties in. I am, as those on HBL, my email list, know, I have become dubious under the influence of Gibson via Lee Pearson, of the existence of such a stage in human infancy and certainly of the need for the concept of sensation. I don't think there is any need in philosophy. I don't think it has any role to play in philosophy. So that's one interesting thing in the perception chapter. In the, I think it's the Norms for Cognition chapter, I come up, no, it's at the end of the Perception chapter, I come up with a phrase or an organizing idea that I'm very proud of. It parallels the idea of the primacy of existence versus the primacy of consciousness. And I call it the primacy of perception versus the primacy of concepts. Now, the primacy of existence or the primacy of consciousness refers to metaphysics. It has it, both those positions have epistemological consequences, but it's basically a position about the relationship in reality of consciousness to existence. The primacy of perception, as I call it, or the primacy of concepts, is strictly epistemological. The primacy of perception, which is, of course, the correct view, says in its metaphysical aspects or with respect to the existence of things, perception is independent of concepts. Concepts are dependent on percepts. Perception is automatic, the conceptual is volitional. And the epistemological implication is perception is the ultimate source of all knowledge. Perceptual data are the given against which all conceptual products are to be judged. The primacy of concepts, which is the Platonic view, holds with regard to the metaphysical side, concepts are independent of perception. Concepts are independent of perception. We can have ideas, theories, and so forth without ever having any perception. Perception is dependent on concepts. This, in the modern parlance, is the idea that perception is theory-laden, very popular in philosophy today. Concepts, it holds, are automatic. Perception is volitional. What an inversion. And epistemologically, the real cash value of the primacy of concepts, false theory, concepts are an independent source of knowledge. Concepts, or mystical revelations, are the given against which the perceptual is to be judged. Now, you may think that's a crazy view, but it's the majority view in the history of philosophy. The British empiricists are a minority position, and I'm afraid it's a minority position today. The primacy of perception is out of fashion in philosophy, but more on that in the course.
Sure. What's your favorite chapter?
I'd have to say the free will chapter, because free will is my favorite subject. But I also have a special fondness for the conceptual knowledge chapter, which was hell to write, but has a lot of new ideas and new hypotheses in it.
Do you cover psychoepistemology in this book?
Yes and no. No, not as a special development, but yes, in that you can't discuss the mechanics of cognition, conceptual cognition, without dealing with the very issues that psychoepistemology deals with. So I discuss the mechanics, conscious and subconscious, of cognition and how they interact. So I think the term psychoepistemology I use about four or five times in the book, but the ideas that are in psychoepistemology are throughout the conceptual level, you know, everything past chapter two.
Okay. When will this book be available in print?
Not for a long time. The main thing that listeners to this need to know is that you can't just wait to get the book. First of all, I have to edit the book. And I should say, you know, in relation to this course, that this course and what I am now completing is a draft. I don't write first drafts, or let us say by the second day after I've written something, it's the second draft. So it's lucid, coherent, rhapsodic prose. But I'm sure some of the things in it are wrong. I know it needs a lot of tightening and editing. I have places where I have notes to myself, is this right? Or fill in a transition here. And one of the great values for me of this course, aside from the money, which is a great value that I'll be earning, is to get input from interested objectivists about the issues that may need changing and may need revision. There are certainly controversial things in this book, and some of them may turn out to need fixing. I may have the wrong view before it hits print. So editing it, assuming that nothing, the major surgery isn't required, and I'm reasonably confident of that. Editing will take about a year. Then publication, if I secured a publisher in a couple of months, it would be a year after I delivered the manuscript before they could get it out. Publication time has lengthened over the years, and it now takes a year. So, you know, realistically, assuming I can even get a good publisher in a short time, I would say a year and a half to 2 years.
So are you saying that if somebody doesn't want to wait for this year and a half or 2 years and wanted the book immediately, the only way to get that is to take the course?
I wouldn't want to be so absolute.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And this is something we haven't said in this interview, but I hope listeners already know. Everybody who takes my course gets free an electronic soft copy of the manuscript of the draft as it now stands, which, again, is not the final version, but is very readable. And there was another thought here. Oh, now we're segueing into the course.
Yes, let's talk about the course now.
Right.
You say that the course is not an exposition of the book. What will the course do, and how will it be conducted?
The course is not an exposition of the book in the sense that I'm not going to simply say, all right, in chapter one I begin by doing this, and I explain that, and then I do this, and in effect recapitulate the book in that chapter in a half an hour, which is the time allotted for this segment of the 1.5 hour course. Each class is 1.5 hours, and the first third is going over the material of the book. It's more in the nature of a book review of that chapter. I will talk about what I think is important, why I'm stating it, if that's not clear, what might be the difficult parts of it, what parts are arguable, and generally give a commentary on the material presented in the chapter. Students or enrollees should have read the chapter before coming to class, so there's no need for me to rehash and expound the doctrines that they will have in advance to read.
And you are asking them to submit questions beforehand after reading it, and you'll be shaping your presentation based on that.
Shrikant is too modest to tell you that this was his innovation. I heartily endorse it. The idea is that enrollees will email me questions in advance of a given lecture. So the lectures are on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. So sometime before Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern, I should have received all the advanced questions from people who've already read that chapter in my book. Now, this will enable me to devote a half an hour to discussing the questions that they raise, not necessarily individually, but there will be themes in them, and they will help me to realize what is unclear in what I have written, or what is controversial, or common objections or misconceptions about what I'm saying. So this will this was Srikant's idea, and I think it will really make the second half hour of each class a very interesting kind of interactive response to the reader's context.
And after that, there is a live question and answer period.
After that, there's a live question and answer period for 30 minutes. So it's three 30-minute segments. Commentary, themes raised in email questions answered, live Q&A. Half hour each, and there'll be a 10-minute break between the second segment and the third segment. You probably now want to ask about the mechanics.
Sure. I mean, there would be some people who have not taken courses by telephone before. How does the conference call part of this work, and how will people get to hear it?
Well, we have an expert here with us, my wife Jean, who is prepared to answer that question.
Thanks, Harry. So I'd like to reassure everyone who hasn't done this before that this is actually a very simple system. All you need is a phone with a touchpad. And what you'll do is we will send you the phone number to call in and the access code to dial when the little voice on the line says, please put in your conference ID number. And that will connect you to a phone bridge. This is a professional system which lets you call in with whatever kind of phone you want, a cell phone, a speaker phone, a cordless phone, Skype, anything that has a keypad and can dial a U.S. phone number will work to call in, and then you can just listen. So you can have whatever comfortable setup you have, if you have an earpiece or a headphone or a speakerphone, that's all fine. Now, some of you who have more experience with teleconference calls may now be worried about the quality of the phone line, because when a lot of people are on cell phones or speaker phones, you can get static on the line. That's not a problem, because we have a system that allows us to mute everyone and then individually unmute people when they, quote-unquote, raise their hands by pressing the star key and the 2 key. And what happens is I will have a screen. This is for the live Q&A, right? For the live Q&A, I will have a screen, and people who want to ask questions will be able to raise their hand, and I will have been able to connect names with phone numbers. So Harry will be able to call on people by name, or maybe I'll be like the radio producer saying, well, we have a question from Srikant, or we have a question from whoever. And so we'll actually be able to call people individually and individually unmute them just for the question, and then mute them up again and take the next question.
Now, you've used this system yourself in your own Thinking Directions classes, right?
Yes, I've used it, and it really makes the teleconference much smoother and easier to run than some of the other systems.
Tell us about how they make up missed classes.
Okay, for making up missed classes, there are going to be two options. One is there will be a phone number that you can call to just get a replay. It's like basically going to be a recording that you can just call up and listen and hear the whole hour and a half recording, and that will be available for 2 weeks after the class. We are currently working on making sure there can also be a way to listen to it on the web. I think that that is definitely going to be possible. And what I'm working on right now is making sure it has good control so that you have a slider bar and can see where you are. So that would be another way. Again, that recording would be up for 2 weeks on the web. And that, so if you do miss a class, you'd have plenty of flexibility for making it up. Probably you'd want to make it up before the next class, but we want to give you a little more flexibility than that.
So the bottom line is that if they know how to use a telephone, they will be able to take this course.
That is the bottom line. Great.
Wonderful.
Okay.
All right. Harry, have you done these kind of teleclasses before? You know, what are the dynamics of a teleclass?
I've taught for many years over a conference bridge at the Objectivist Academic Center. I find it works if I can also see some people live in class. Just talking into a telephone to either a small or large number of people is a little deadly. So I'm having a few friends over, including Srikant and Jean, to be live participants, only about 4 or 5 people. So I will be able to see the reactions on the faces of the people who are sitting around my dining room table as I give this class. And I think that'll keep it lively, give me the feedback I need to make it clear when I'm getting across and when I'm not.
Wonderful. Do you want to make any closing statements? Anything else you want to say about the course?
I just want to thank Srikant, who took on the unpaid role as of my writing coach for the last, three years, without whom I would not be half as far in this book as I am. And where I am is, I would say, 1 week from completing the whole first draft. So Srikant deserves my eternal gratitude, not just for that, but for his very intelligent comments, not uncritical comments either, of each section as we discussed it. He came and met with me once a week, every week for the last 3 years, babysitting this through, it's usually talked about in terms of pregnancy, so. The Lamaze procedure for intellectual production. Other than that, I'm really looking forward to this class. I think it'll both be an exciting event for me and for you and lead to a great improvement in the final draft of the book.
Wonderful, Harry. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
This is Jean Binswanger again. Thank you for listening to this interview with Dr. Binswanger. If you'd like to enroll in his class on How We Know, the cost is only $395 if you enroll by February 7th. After that, the price goes up to $450, though there is a three-pay option in which you can pay in three equal payments of $150. You can find out all about this, more information on the course, and register online at hblist.com/LECS. That's hblist.com/LECS. Or you can email me for more information at info@hblist.com. That's info@hblist.com.